All right, hello, welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I'm Jason Napolitano, and on the line, Mr. Chris Sheridan is here. How you doing, Chris?
Very dark. It's dark out, it's nighttime, but it's also coming upon the winter solstice, where it's the shortest day and thus the longest night of the year. So by dark, I guess I just mean physical darkness. It's dark out.
It is.
Dark out. Isn't that a song? No, that's
I don't know, but it should be these days.
But every year, this is where we find ourselves, around the Hanukkah, Christmas, New Year area. Yeah. And short days, long nights, but the sun returns.
The sun returns indeed.
Solstice, after it stops.
Absolutely.
It's back, so.
Great segue into what we're talking about today on the Cosmic Eye Show, which is the death of myth and the resurrection of meaning. The resurrection of meaning. So we're going to get into that in a moment. I want to thank you for joining us here each Sunday and on Friday for our Emmett Fox show as well, Emmett Fox Friday show. We are at anchor.fm/cosmiceye if you'd like to make a donation. Chris's book is The Spirit in the Sky. Mine is If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. Both those are available on Amazon. So if you can, please support us by buying our books. Making donations to the podcast as well. You know, we're trying to keep this thing moving forward, and any help we can get, we'd really appreciate it. And also, please share with your friends on social media if you can, so we can get the word out. You know, we're trying to share positive information, ancient wisdom, psychology, esoteric wisdom, and so on through the show. And if you're listening to us, I mean, you know, we're not preaching to the converted. You are you realize the value of this material. And so please help us get it out there to more people. You know, it's one of these things where we can create that sort of paradigm shift. The more people that know and practice and understand this information in their lives, the more that we can create that better world that we're all moving towards, right? That resurrection of meaning, as it were, that resurrection of myth and value and so on that we're seeking. So we can find our ways in life. All right, so let us jump into the death of myth and the resurrection of meaning. Thank you, Chris, for that beautiful title, by the way. All right, so what does this mean, the death of myth, the resurrection of meaning? So the death of myth is this idea. It's pretty pervasive these days. You can hear, you know, you hear a lot about it in a lot of the modern teachings, particularly in the Jungian circles, but even the Freudians speak about this. So the idea that there is a myth that we're contained in, our culture is contained in, and that, you know, provides meaning for us. For most people, for, you know, throughout the, up to at least the, nearly the end of the 19th century, most people were contained in the Judeo-Christian myth. And I don't mean myth in the sense that it's untrue. I mean myth in the sense of mythos or worldview. And for the West, that also included the Greek mythological viewpoint as well, which is certainly intermixed with the Judeo-Christian philosophy. And most people found themselves firmly ensconced and cocooned within that worldview. And it was, you know, you found your meaning in life. From that, it provided you a sort of sense of understanding and guidance. Again, it doesn't mean that everyone believes that and everyone agrees with every single dogma and tenet of all those particular branches of, you know, of Judaism and Christianity, but it means that mainly most people are at least contained with and understand the myth that those worldviews represent. In other words, there's an ethical and a philosophical, theological structure that you live in that provides an overall meaning for your life. Okay, so this worldview served us in a great way for a long time. It structured our legal systems. It structured our economic system. It structured our school, you know, our school and educational systems. It structured our family and social systems. You know, people were married in churches or synagogues. The laws of the church and synagogue were paramount in most people's lives, at least, up until, I'd say the, you know, the late 1700s, early 1800s, and in this country, really up until the 1900s, the church held sway until probably the, even the 1950s here, where, you know, the U.S. is a very religious country. And, you know, Europe was far more secular and has been far more secular for far longer than we have. You know, and even today, there's a good amount of people who still consider them, you know, themselves observant Christians and Jews in this country, as well as other faiths. But the idea here then is that, you know, there was an overriding mythological understanding of how the world worked, and that gave people meaning in their lives. And that is something that famously was described by, you know, once that ended, that was famously described by Nietzsche as he went in and saying, God is dead. And he by no means felt that that was a good thing. And he predicted, you know, the terrors of, you know, World War II and all of these different movements and the, you know, the Soviet Revolution and all of these different things in much of his work. He was a genius, even though he was a very troubled man. So he saw that move into this modern viewpoint, what you'd call the modern viewpoint. Now we've moved into a different, more abstracted viewpoint, which is the postmodern view. The modern viewpoint is this more or less the scientific objective worldview, where we do not see any meaning attached to things. We just see objects out there to be studied, you know, through scientific methodology. And most people don't necessarily have a narrative of meaning in their lives any longer. And the idea then that this death of myth, you know, and the death of God that Nietzsche spoke of is this sort of spiritual vacuum that, you know, the modern world finds itself in. So we're going to talk about that and how we can resurrect some meaning in our own life and, you know, some of the problems with not having a myth and not being contained in some sort of mythological worldview. And again, you know, this idea of myth, it doesn't mean it's a falsity. It's a worldview, a spiritual construct, a tale that is, you know, truer than true. So that's how we're looking at myth. It's not a disparaging way that we're saying this word, that I'm saying this word. I don't know. You have a good definition of myth as well, right?
Well, I do. I can't attribute it because I don't remember, but a myth is a story that never was, but always is.
That's great.
Yeah. Never was, but always is. So yeah, it may not actually be true. Maybe there wasn't a little boy who actually cried wolf when there wasn't a wolf, until people didn't believe him any longer. And then he got eaten up when he yelled wolf when there really was a wolf and no one bought it. That may or may not have really happened, and it really doesn't matter. But raising a false alarm and the consequences of that, that always is. That is something that guides our life. That's why we have these, you know, teeny myths, whether they're little, you know, nursery tales. They tell us something about ourselves, who we are, and how to live in this world, whether it's the world of nature or the world of relationships with, you know, family and other people we come in contact with. And it's so important because, you know, some people even think that myths are stored in the body, that we are just myth creatures. And I'll kind of take a quick side bar, if I will, and talk about like conspiracy theories. A lot of the reasoning behind having a far out explanation for something is because it was lacking explanation. The story didn't add up. So then maybe somebody else can say, well, maybe it's because Earth is flat, or, you know, JFK killed, the Greenpeace dealer. I don't know what happened, but, you know, it sounds outlandish and they sound very kooky, but they are attempts at finishing the story or somehow making sense of this narrative, this myth that isn't holding up. There's something empty. And I think, you know, we'll go along and kind of describe how some of these strong myths have been really diluted with the scientific worldview and industrial revolution, very important growth that we have to go through. And I'm on board with science and everything, but some things happened along the way. And I think we're a little not any better for the cause.
Well, it's an interesting thing because we'll look at an interesting example of where, you know, a deeply entrenched experiment, let's say, or a very heavy-handed experiment of actually, you know, an intensified idea of actually killing off religion, you know, occurred in the Soviet Union, you know, under the totalitarian communism that existed in the Soviet Union. And what actually happened there was a mythologizing of the state. And then these leaders, you know, deified, you know, the gigantic, you know, statues of Lenin and Marx and Stalin that went up, and, you know, and the ritualistic marches and the uniforms and this whole new system of propaganda symbology that was created, which is really pretty interesting and remarkable when you look back on it. And actually, there's a highly collectible market of Soviet propaganda now. You know, there's a whole groups of collectors that, you know, the posters and all of the stuff now, because they don't do that any longer. It's a relic of a bygone era. But they basically turned socialism or communism into a religion. The very thing that they rejected, you know, they made religion illegal, essentially, and then turned politics into a quasi-religious sort of system, you know, where the state is all powerful and these leaders are deified and, you know, there's a whole system of, you know, creeds that you've got to believe. And everyone knew they were lies, but they would say them to themselves over and over again and try to talk themselves into these, you know, certain beliefs and so on. And, you know, it's very interesting because, you know, like you said, I mean, we're bound in story, narrative, and mythology as human beings. And I mean, our neurobiology is intertwined with storytelling and myth making. We seem to be wired for story. We're wired for myth. We're wired for folklore. You know, it's the way that we most effectively learn through these metaphors and analogies and so on, and these spiritual symbols and, you know, mythological contents of these different, you know, tales and ritual enactments of things and so on. It's literally how we're wired. You know, so to try to get rid of that or to not have a structure of meaning for our lives is very difficult. And this is some of the work that Jung took very seriously as well as a student of Nietzsche's. You know, and Jung was very fond of his work, and not a direct student of him, but a student in the sense that he studied his work very seriously. And so, you know, he was very interested in understanding how we could work on creating individual myths for ourselves to live by, and find our correct path for ourselves that may be outside of any sort of orthodox religious group. And it really is probably, you know, the only solution that some people are going to find today. And, you know, you would say, look, if you're contained within a particular religious tradition or cultural tradition that works for you and gives you meaning, you know, stick with it. You know, grow beyond it psychologically if you need to, but there's no reason to jettison that. And he was even in favor of, you know, people who had moved away from their own religious traditions to actually kind of reinvestigate it in a new way. And, you know, his father, Jung's father, was a pastor. I believe he's a Calvinist pastor, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, so he grew up in that very restricted sort of worldview and so on, that, you know, that kind of shaped Swiss culture at the time and so on. And had to develop his own way, you know. And now we kind of find ourselves in an opposite situation where most people don't grow up with religion or with any sort of mythological constraints around them or teachings. so that we're just adrift. And that's where we talk about this death myth. You know, it's not that these things don't exist. Obviously, religions exist, and obviously mythology exists, and, you know, people are very active in New Age things and so on. It's just that, you know, we don't have any overall cultural structure that holds us all together. So now we're all busy trying to create our own individual meanings about life, and that's the kind of struggle. And then how do we match that with a sort of cultural cohesive understanding that can keep us all on the same page? Because that's where, you know, what it means to be contained within a myth is that we're all kind of on board with the, you know, the same sort of philosophical and ethical ideas, and we can create laws around that, and most people buy into that, and it keeps society structured and stable. Without that kind of mythology, how do we construct a stable, ethical, you know, well-functioning society is really what Jung was concerned with, and what anyone who's looking at this idea of the death of myth is concerned with, myself and you included, right, Chris?
Well, right, and that implies that, you know, if without this myth we don't have the guidance, it implies that the myth is the guidance. It is this guiding principle, the guiding story, the guiding set of instructions, through rites of passage. And this is ancient. This goes way back. Myths were very, very close, very personally, whether it's the government of the tribal council, or the family structure, or the clan, deeply involved in ritual, deeply involved with these myths, because they told a story. One of the first stories they ever told was the story of the sun. The sun rising, the sun setting, the seasons. I mentioned earlier about the solstice. The sun appears to stop and then it starts warming up again. It was because we live so close to the earth and nature and these forces. Like when springtime came around in a lot of areas, it was a big deal. Now it's like, well, okay, I can just turn my heater down and later on I'll turn the air conditioner up. It's kind of an inconvenience. It's not ruling your life. Like, yeah. So nature was a common myth, and everybody was on board with it all over the world for centuries, for millennia, because that was part of everybody's everyday life, this astrotheological notion. But I think what happened is with, you know, talking about governments like, you know, communism having to destroy some of these myths, but in doing so ended up kind of creating their own. Because you can't avoid it. Same thing with religion. Religion, you know, especially in the last 2,000 years, had a tendency to cut off the more mythic, the more meaningful aspects of, say, pagan or indigenous cultures. So in a way, religion, especially, you know, with the new Christianity and, you know, the 300s of this current era, going forward, kind of took the meat, kind of took the meaning out of it. So then you have empty rituals, and then you have dogma, and then you have power structures. Well, even science came along and said, well, you know, religion is superstitious. You believe in some sky god that you can't even see. This is absurd. Well, let me tell you about gravity, you know, and then here's just some other force that you can't see, or the weak atomic nuclear force or something that you can't really seem to avoid it, no matter how much you try to destroy it. And now science has become, well, you just don't believe in science. If somebody challenges your opinion on something, and that's what a religion in power would have said 500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't believe in, you know,
yeah,
Christ or something. And then, so I'll burn you at the stake. There you go. How do you like that? You know, we kind of skewer people now if they don't believe in science. But it's not something you really need to believe in. Look at the missions to, you know, from JPL and NASA and things like that. It's, you know, the Apollo, it's Mercury, it's Artemis, you know, the Atlas rocket, you know, they're all named after mythological figures and heroes in the constellation. So you can't get away from it, no matter how you try. It still comes up again, because that's who we are. That's really who we are. And I think this, I want to talk, you know, I'll put it over to you Maybe we can talk about, you know, why this death? Why was it killed off in the first place? And in some ways, there's a good reason. If myth gets too crystallized or too superstitious or holding somebody back, then you can't advance in some other areas.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, and I think, you know, you know, many people have pointed out, Edward Ettinger being one of them. Ettinger was a Jungian in Los Angeles, and he has a lot of great talks on YouTube that you can check out. But he spoke about the idea of, you know, these people that were involved in sort of bringing this about. I mean, you think about, like, you know, Da Vinci and Galileo and, you know, the Renaissance artists and the early scientists and so on. And, you know, much of this, the seeds that were, you know, that kind of eventually grew into this death of myth, let's call it, you know, were sown by individuals who were actually, you know, pious individuals who themselves were, you know, if they weren't really necessarily, you know, church going folks, they, you know, they were spiritual people. They believed that they were doing something that was enlightening individuals and furthering knowledge and wisdom and so on by investigating these new scientific ideas and, you know, developing a new worldview. And the ironic thing is that, for example, one of the people that gets often blamed for, you know, this sort of split between mind and body and this split between, you know, spirit and matter and this idea that, you know, this scientific objective theory is Descartes, you know. And the crazy thing about Descartes that most people don't know is that an angel came to him in a dream and told him to start spreading this idea of objective science. People do not realize that. All these people that talk about objective science and, you know, the truth and we have to believe in science, the endeavor was created by a vision of an angel. That I find fascinating. But so these people thought that they were, you know, they were moving in a direction, and they were, you know, many, many good things came out of the scientific revolution. Many great inventions, and much suffering was relieved because of it. And certainly much superstitious, dogmatic, you know, persecuting type behavior was mitigated. You know, we're moving towards a much more tolerant society and so on, and all of that. And much of that is, you know, is because of this movement towards this more objective scientific quote unquote worldview. But you know, but what we've lost along the way is that containment of, you know, that the myth provided before, that gave us meaning and structure in our lives. You know, and in a sense, by moving towards this more objective scientific worldview, you know, we killed off all of the mystery and meaning in things. And now, you know, this is why science is a beautiful tool to use, and it's a wonderful thing, but it is not a philosophical outlook that is going to give you any kind of satisfaction in life, because it's not even trying to investigate questions of meaning. Meaning has nothing to do with the objective scientific worldview, but meaning has a great deal to do with human life. And that's what we forget. Like, science is great for looking at things, you know, in a somewhat objective way, you know, to isolate certain things and figure things out and, you know, have these reproducible experiments and so on. But it has nothing to do with the soul. In fact, it would postulate that there isn't a soul, because they can't measure it, weigh it, and see it. You know, and we know that there's something which exists in us that is a spirit or a soul. You know, we can feel that, we sense it. Something leaves the body. You know, we can it's a sort of a priori idea that, you know, most of us hold. Most people in science probably believe that as well. It's something that human beings just seem to sense about themselves. There's a spiritual part and a physical part, and at death, the spiritual part goes somewhere else. You know what I mean? And this thing is that, you know, the challenge is that, you know, this worldview that we've adopted after this death of myth is basically kind of this conglomeration of consumerism, you know, pop psychology, and, you know, these democratic ideals that we hold so dear, and which are great, but they're not a mythological worldview. You know, they're a political system. And then, you know, some consumerism thrown in for good measure. And there's no meaning in any of those things. I mean, there's no inherent meaning in them. You know, whereas mythology is teaching you how you should live. It's a question of how should we be. You know, philosophy talks about how you should act. You know, science and sociology and even psychology, for the most part today, is telling us how we do act, or what is going on, or where these problems are, what these social structures do. But it's not providing any kind of guide to what we should be doing. And that's where that lack of meaning is. And that's why we're talking about in our title, we have the death of myth and the resurrection of meaning. Because without meaning, what is life for? You know what I mean?
I do. And it's this, you know, notion that the myth contained within the myth is meaning, or better yet, the mythological framework is the pathway through which you can discover meaning. You know, the myth doesn't necessarily give you the meaning, but it's the path of discovery of meaning. It's the journey you take. That, especially any kind of inner meaning, which you know, is incredibly important, vital to you know, to our larger self. And you mentioned, like, you know, psychology and where that's come from. It was originally called the science of the soul.
Yeah, exactly.
Eology, you know. That's kind of its name, but it really doesn't do it. You're talking about behaviors, which are things already done, not what causes the behaviors.
Yeah.
Or what's behind the thought that caused you to do this thing? What's the feeling, you know, involved? Or what's your soul's longing that, you know, you may not even know? Or your shadow elements, all these things. That's why depth psychology, I think, is really a strong attempt, and I think very largely successful, in bringing back some of these things, because it has been lost. Well, religion killed it off because, you know, that became the power structure. And then science sort of killed what was left off because of, you know, all the superstition. And they're all great. They're all great ways to look at it. But one person we study a lot, Manly P. Hall, suggests that philosophy is sort of the framework or the bridge that'll get us back by moving forward, not going back, but it'll help reintegrate, resurrect some of these meaningful things, because it does ask those questions. Should we be doing this? Science says, asks, how do we split the atom? Oh, well, here's how we do it. Well, how do we make a bomb? Well, here's a bomb. Okay, well, how do we drop it? Well, put it on this plane. There you go. It didn't really ask, should we build this bomb or drop it? Those are in the realm of philosophy. And also any other kind of moral code, you know, religions and things like that, you know, do that. It asks you, well, why? Why a bomb? Why this bomb? Should we drop it? Should we drop more? I don't know. But science really doesn't care. And there's a real gift with science, especially when you're talking about things of the soul and psychology. I think using that scientific framework can really help solve some of our mysterious psychological riddles, if applied properly. You know, because scientifically, if you're able to step back and look at yourself, let's say, it's easier to look at somebody else, especially a friend of yours, and tell them what's wrong with them, because you can see it more clearly. But if you can step back from, like, the emotional bit and the personalization and how I've been harmed in this situation, and just take a real honest look scientifically, you might discover some things that you wouldn't, because you're mired or embroiled in all the emotional, you know, trappings mm-hmm. that go along with your situation. Or there's even the notion of scientific prayer that we talk about, and I think Emmett Fox goes into as well, that if you try something scientifically, through experimentation, you conduct a certain operation in the laboratory of your life, and if you get results, well, that's scientific, even if it is a prayer or a meditation or something you're doing that might be, you know, more towards the realm of religion or spirituality. But you can even use a scientific way of looking at that. Well, maybe my chanting and dancing isn't really helping because I have a bad attitude about life. Maybe that needs to be worked on. And you can look at yourself scientifically. All these things have limits. They are lenses through which we can look at ourselves in the world. Each one maybe looks at things a little bit differently. And if we can, you know, why choose? Why not use religion, science, philosophy, and the arts and psychology to try to solve this riddle? You know, or at least find where to go.
That's a great point. And I think that's where that idea of philosophy and, you know, Manly Hall's idea of bridging all those things, you know, in the original name of the PRS, you know, philosophy, religion, and science, you know, a philosophical research society, they're both, you know, both synonymous with that PRS, acronym that they used. He's trying to bridge all those things and say, hey, let's use all of these great tools to investigate the world. But again, that's a different worldview than saying, okay, I've got to believe in either science or religion, or I've got to believe in science or, you know, a mythological or earth religious based view of the world, or, you know, something like this. It's like, you know, you're seeing those things, as dichotomies. And in a sense, they are, you know, we have to be realistic, you know, there are opposites. You know, and that's one of the beautiful things about Jung's work, is he was adamant about being able to hold the opposites. Because, you know, this idea that, you know, that there's, a thesis and antithesis and everything, you know, there's hot and there's cold. There are opposites, you know, and there are this tension between those two things. There is spirit and there is matter. Are they in opposition? You know, it depends. That's the answer. It depends. It could be, you know, it depends on where you place yourself in them. And he would talk about holding the place, holding the tension between the opposites. And that was the way to overcome them and then to be able to transcend them. You know, the Buddha talked about the middle path, you know, the middle path. And there's this idea in Kabbalah of the middle pillar between these two extremes, the two pillars in Freemasonry. Boaz and Joaquin are the same idea. It's like the middle path is where you go between the two extremes, between the black and the white.
Taoism with yin and yang.
Oh, sure, the yin yang symbol, exactly. All of that. It's like
what we're just talking about right now. I'll just interrupt. That's a myth. That is a mythological framework that these opposites are connected. They don't exist without each other. And according to those traditions that we just listed, the goal is to bring those together, as well as Jung felt that. But that's a mythological construct. That's a framework. That's a story of looking at opposing forces instead of, well, one's good, the other one's evil. I want this one in my life, and I want to completely kill the other one off. You can't do that. That's not really what opposing forces are. They don't exist without each other.
Great point. Yeah, thank you.
It's for a reason. It's the earth. Half of the earth is light, half of the earth is dark, all the time.
Yeah.
Where you live, it may be spinning, and you know, it could be on the bright part or on the dark part, who knows, but if you step back far enough, half the planet's lit and half the planet's not at any given time. So we live in a cosmology of opposing forces because that's the way we're constructed. Our bodies have left and right-hand sides. We have an inside and an outside. There's up and down. That's how we can orient anything.
Yep.
We couldn't live without these opposites. Figure and ground. How could you see a picture if the background and the foreground were the same, color and value? It would be invisible. It would be camouflage.
Yeah.
So we need these things. But, you know, just to get back to this myth, that is a myth. And I think what we have in this country, in the West, in the United States, I can speak for because this is where I live, we have somehow bought into the notion that there's good and evil, and the good is going to win, and you just have to get rid of the evil. And what is the evil? Well, not me. The other guy, the other culture, the other person, the one who's wearing the other, you know, the red cap and not the blue cap. You know, it gets broken down that, well, we're just going to defeat them. We're going to destroy them. It's like, no, you can't. It's, they exist as opposites because of each other, not in spite of each other. That's a different mythological framework. It's a different construct at looking at these things. And we're stuck in this dualism, this fight between light and dark, or whatever you want to call it, male and female, red and blue. And there's no solution to it. The only solution is the harmony that the yin yang, the Tai Chi symbol, you know, really demonstrates. Or like you talk about Jung saying, holding these opposing things, like one in each hand. Got the red on in this hand and the blue on that hand, or the black and the white, and I'm holding them together. Mm-hmm. Not which one's right or which one's better, which one shouldn't do this, which one shouldn't do that. It's like, no, they're together.
Yeah.
And so that's a myth. And when we lose these myths, whether it's from Taoism or Buddhism or Kabbalah, and lose touch with them, or the myth that nature gives us with night and day. And then you have the solstice now in the winter when it's kind of cold and dark, and in the summer when it's warm and bright more often than it's dark. Though that's a myth, that's a story. And we've even just lost touch with nature and what's really around us, our whole cosmology.
Yeah, exactly. And
or because of that, I think some of this political infighting could really benefit from a huge dose of Taoism.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Sure. I completely agree. You know, and one of the things too, like another, you know, some people have suggested that that a new mythology that we might move towards is a mythology of regeneration and sustainability for the earth. In other words, looking at the earth as a, you know, as a finite closed system that needs our help and efforts in preserving and living with it in balance, and looking at the natural order of ecosystems and operating within natural limits, you know, and not, and that's a new sort of a mythology. Some, you know, some people call that sustainability. Some people call it permaculture. You know, there's many, some people call it regenerative agriculture or conservation. There's many different names and approaches to it, but it's one of these things that, you know, that that's a sort of earth-wide thing that's needed, and that everyone can see. For example, the idea that, you know, there's a scarcity, for example, of fish at the market, and you know why that is. Because the oceans are poisoned and with chemicals, and they're overfished, you know, with scientifically guided boats. You know, the problem with our technology is that it allows us to rape the resources of the earth at you know, such an astounding and alarming rate that we could literally use up all of its resources, you know, within a matter of, you know, years if it were completely unchecked and we just, you know, ran amok. You know, the combination of the huge population, the massive growth of economic wealth around the world, and this, you know, coupled with, you know, with this, I, you know, this massive ability, technological ability to excavate things and to blow things up and knock things down and cut through, you know, I mean, they can cut through forests like a, you know, a hot knife through butter now. It's, there's no impediment to, you know, it used to be that, you know, our tools were limited. You know, we could saw a giant redwood down. It would take, you know, I don't know how long it took, but, you know, these trees are giant, you know, and it's a massive undertaking to try to harvest them, you know, and things like that. But now with the tools that we have, you know, it's just, it's silly. And it's, you know, it's incredible. I mean, it's a testament to our inventiveness and our technological prowess. but it's scary. And without the containment of meaning and ethical constraint, we are a serious danger to ourselves and the planet. That's the reality of it. And you talked about the atomic bomb earlier. That's one of those things. It's like we probably should have really looked at that as a race of individuals, a human race, and said, you know what? We're probably not spiritually and philosophically advanced enough for this technology. It's better left alone. But again, it was wartime conditions, and I get it. I get the fears and things that were going on, and that the enemy is developing this. I get all that. I understand. But the point is, we've got to develop a system of ethical guidelines, and that hold us together. And one of these things that's a possibility, if not even a probability, is this idea of this sort of one Earth, spaceship Earth idea, and us uniting as human beings on a little spinning globe that's out in the middle of nowhere. You know what I mean? And now that we know that, we've seen that image of the Earth from space and so on, and we can use that image and kind of tie that into an ecological and sort of philosophical and ethical understanding of our place on the Earth. That's one new sort of mythological outlook, that ecological outlook that can, most people, even if they're going to argue about climate change and whether or not this or that is going on and how they feel about it, I think the average person walking down the street knows there's a problem and knows that we need to do something about it. They may not be in agreement what that is, but they can definitely think of a time, like, for example, even the most conservative people have to notice that a fairly small fillet of salmon is now $18. And when you were a kid, we could get a whole salmon for practically nothing up in Seattle, because they were plentiful. That's in my lifetime. You know what I'm saying? So these are things that you see are going on, and you know they're happening. You can't argue about them. You see the rainforests are being chopped down. You see that, we're spreading at an alarming rate into all this, wildlife land and so on. And we've got to look at that. And I think that could be something that we could think about as a sort of new paradigm. Like, how do we get along on a small planet in an ethical way and, behave responsibly towards all living creatures, including the flora and fauna? Right?
That term sustainability and permaculture, up until a couple hundred years ago, that was just life.
Yeah, exactly.
You milked the cow to make the butter. When the cow died, you tanned the hide and made a leather jacket or chaps. And when you raised the sheep, you would shear the wool, you would spin the yarn, you would make the sweater that you would wear when you go out to milk the cow. I mean, it was, you had to have everything. You had to have disposal. You used compost. But that's just how you lived, especially on the frontier, when you're out in the, in with nature. That was just the way of life. That mm-hmm. was the myth. That was the overriding set of instructions, because that's how you got the job done. That's how you were able to live. It had to happen that way. We've lost that. So this return, this resurrection of that myth, yes, it's going to come in and it's going to bring technology, and it's going to bring this kind of global village that we have that we didn't before. It's not really going backwards, but it's bringing back through something that had been lost. And it was right then, and it's right, by right I mean correct, now. But when these things get re-mythologized, like sustainability, they will come with the new language and this time for the people who live now, because we've already lost it. We've already lost the old myth. Yeah. It's in us somewhere. It's dormant. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to go back on the frontier and make our own stocks. Some people can, but that's not practical for most people.
Yeah.
And the irony, the tragedy really, is that at that time of the Industrial Revolution, when people were living in a sustainable way for the most part, when they started hacking down forests and pulling coal and oil out of the ground and polluting and all that, there, for a while, there was still, the earth could handle that. You're cutting this down, but there's so much of it, and there's only so few people. That's flipped, but the problem is we're still operating under that paradigm. I think not the sustainability one, but the fact that, oh, there's always more trees.
There's always
plenty of fish in the ocean. That's not really true, but we're operating that way. So that is really where the urgency is for this new myth. Because we're using the technology and tools of today with a story that isn't really true now.
You're absolutely right about that. You hit the nail on the head with that. It's an old mythological construct. It's the idea that if this runs out, then we'll go get something else. If we run out of space, we'll just keep moving west. If, you know, we can take more land if we need it. Those myths now don't hold up, but we act as if there's always going to be more. There's always going to be more. Instead of looking at, you know, the earth as, you know, having finite resources and infinite, you know, needs and desires placed upon them. So, you know, that's where we have to put ourselves in alignment with the way the earth naturally functions again, and start looking at, you know, just like you said, going back to, you know, and it's not going in reverse. Obviously, we're not going to all go back and live on homesteads, and we're not all going to go live out in, you know, permaculture communes and stuff. It's not realistic. But we have to, you know, move towards a society that does things in a way that is sustainable. And that, it definitely involves a new type of mythological worldview. Like you said, we've been inundated with this idea of really, it's a consumerist ideal in a way. That's what it's turned into. It used to be the idea of, you know, infinite natural resources, because the United States had abundant natural resources. It had massive forests that these people had never seen the likes of, you know, massive amounts of game and fish, and, you know, it looked like there was an endless supply for everyone all the time. But once technology began to harvest things, and, you know, and the human element was removed, and you began to do things with, you know, massive amounts of horsepower because of petroleum, it changed the whole paradigm. And, you know, we still think, well, there's, you know, we're just one scientific idea or, you know, or revolution or new technological advancement away from fixing this. Well, if, you know, if food runs out, you know, science will figure something out. We'll just, you know, we'll eat protein pellets that they manufacture there's always this mythological idea that science will figure out some way of solving the problem. And that's another mythology that we believe in. And this is where I say, you know, there's a death of myth in a sense, but then, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. So new mythology, you know, moves in. That new mythology is, you know, the Marxist ideal or the utopian society or free market capitalism or, you know, liberal, you know, neoliberal, you know, democratic institutions or whatever you believe in, and those become your mythologies and your religions, you know, and you know what I'm saying? And so it's less of a death of myth as a sort of death of traditional myth. And the thing is these traditional myths, to get back to that idea, they really do explain the human experience. They, you know, and they do stand the test of time. I mean, some of these myths, you know, these Babylonian myths and these Egyptian mythologies, and even the mythology that's contained in Christianity and Judaism, the stories and the historical accounts as well, that explain things are, you know, told in mythological ways. In addition, you know, I'm not saying that everything is divorced from history, but those things have stood the test of time, and they talk about the human condition. They talk about the journey of the soul. They talk about ethics and what it means to be an ethical human being. you know, the stories that Buddha told, and, you know, the images in his different, you know, mythological stories and so on. All these are guiding us to show us, you know, how to live. You know, some of them we need to update and modify, and some of them we need to interpret in a new way, you know, with the new findings we have in science and so on. And, you know, we have to open up this mythology in a different light now and so on. But it's all still valid. And that's why there's this resurrection of meaning in some ways can be, you know, like a resurrection of the old ways, the old systems, the old traditions, but, you know, in a new way, you know. So, and that's where, that was one of the things, again, get back to Jung, he would talk about, it's like, you know, he would always ask clients, you know, patients of, if they had any kind of, you know, religious beliefs or if they had any sort of religious upbringing, and he would delve into that, you know, and oftentimes recommend that they go back and kind of investigate those beliefs, because even if you don't practice those religious beliefs, and even if you, you know, or, you know, find them abhorrent for some reason, there's going to be value in looking at them and trying to study them and maybe understand them in a new way. Because obviously, if you're really, you know, incensed by these ideas, they've made a profound impact on you. And one of the things I found, and we've talked about this before, not so much on the show, but one of the things I found is many people who are very hardline vocal atheists grew up in evangelical Christian households, or with a, you know, father that was a pastor, you know, or in some kind of situation that made them really averse to Christianity. I found that oftentimes many atheists, not all, and again, I'm not trying to generalize, but the people that I've spoken to oftentimes have had a very bad experience with Christianity. You know what I mean? And so in some ways, even an atheist would, I think, you know, find some value in going back and looking at Christianity in a sense of, and trying to investigate what pushes your buttons about it so much. Is it the structure? Is it the dogma? Is it the history of, like, the Catholic Church and its, you know, bloody persecutions of people? Is it, you know, is it the mythological structure and the stories itself? I mean, what is it about that that's pushing your buttons? Because there's going to be some shadow material there that's going to help you psychologically. And you might discover something about yourself. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, and that would be true with any kind of
meaning. Anything. Yeah.
Is to actually go deeply into it and find out what's behind it, because it is easy in some way, certainly natural, to want to reject something that has hurt you and move in the opposite direction and do everything you can to subvert or criticize or tear down you know, the wounding institution in the first place. But yeah, sure. I mean, I would say all the religions, maybe to a lesser degree, some of the Eastern ones, but, you know, even Hinduism, but you could certainly say Christianity, and I, you know, I would say Judaism and Islam as well, have suffered from the institutionalization of what was originally a mystic or, you know, mythic, actually, tradition.
Absolutely.
Power structure of the church or the priesthood with the Hebrews of the Near East, or, you know, you have the different factions now of Islam, you know, fighting each other, killing each other, just like the Catholics and the Protestants. I mean, you have this infighting even within these traditions. So there's a lot to not like about them. But the institution, or say Christianity Incorporated, if you want to, you know, put a label on it, is not really the Christianity of Jesus, if you want to go all the way back.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a lot of the things have been perverted, subverted, and to some degree science as well, because science is conducted by human beings. It's a human thing. So whether it's a government, you know, a scientific structure, or a religious tradition, they can all become distorted and oppressive, even though they set out trying to help. Maybe they were birthed in a response to something that was terrible, and this seemed to be the better way. That's just a human being thing, that we're prone to that, susceptible to that. But I think these things can save themselves. science can save itself if it goes back to scientific skepticism instead of scientific dogmatism. And this, you know, we have these saints in science, practically. It's like, wait a minute, you still got to have that skeptical, let's see, let's just see. The science is not settled. If a scientist says the science is settled, they're not really a scientist, or they're not really using the original foundational tradition of science. And that is that our knowledge is constantly changing. We know more and more, and the more we know, a lot of times the more we discover that we don't know. And religion too, if they can go deeply back into maybe the origin and the simple universal truths that are comforting, are instructive, are unifying, go back to those. And don't worry about, you know, all this other stuff, the structure of this, or the government this, or the caliphate, or the priest, or the, you know, that's something else. That's not the real, you know, thread, the real core, the essence of these religious or governments. You're talking about socialism and communism. You know, there's some really good stuff in there if you go all the way back. Yeah. But then you put a uniform and you fight a war and you kill these people because you're trying to save them. Yeah, you're really missing the point.
Sure, absolutely. You know, that's a great point. I think you're right. The institutionalization of stuff can oftentimes kill the mystery and the mythology behind it, right? And the good things that are in it, you know, because it becomes static and dogmatic and even dangerous and oppressive. But if you look for the mystical and mythical behind these ideas, whether they're, you know, religious or social or political ideas, and, you know, kind of look at the real ethical and philosophical underpinnings of them, you know, you can find things of great value. And so it's like, this is where I think this idea of resurrection of meaning comes in. It's like, in some ways, you know, if you haven't had any kind of religious background or any kind of, you know, philosophical or kind of spiritual background, you know, you're just going to have to experiment and read and explore different things to see. But if you were brought up in a tradition, or at least around one, or it's in your lineage or something in some way or another, there may be a way for you to get into that kind of thing that's sort of archetypally sort of pre-wired into you, in a sense, because it is in your cultural DNA, let's call it, and find a sort of a mystical path into it that doesn't get so caught up in the dogmatic and the oppressive elements of it, but more of the free spirit. So, for example, like if you're studying Christianity, you know, study the mystics, you know, Meister Eckhart, and you might study Teresa of Avila, and you know, and some of these great saints and so on, Saint Francis, and you know, and look at these people that embodied the real spirit of mystical Christianity. You study some of the Rosicrucian work, and even the New Thought stuff is really based in those ideas, you know, in those mystical and mythical ideas. So, you know, there may be a way into your tradition that gives you you know, a sort of resurrection of meaning. Or you may need something completely new. And that's where we talked about a little bit about the idea of this kind of spaceship Earth idea, this idea of one Earth, sustainability as a sort of philosophical and ethical way of living in the world, looking at those kinds of ideas. You know, other ideas that, you know, you might do to find some resurrection of meaning and to find meaning and orientation in your life. Study Jung's work, you know, and you know, a good entry point is Robert Johnson's work, you know, because what's there is this archetypal way of looking at religions where you can find the core sort of universal qualities that are in religion that you might be able to apply to your own life and still look at, you know, different traditions like Buddhism and Hinduism and, you know, Islam and, you know, Native American tradition, shamanism, whatever. You begin to see the building blocks and the sort of archetypal elements, and you can construct something that works for you if you understand the framework behind it. So that can be a way in. you know, looking at the natural world, you spoke about the natural world a little bit, and just kind of getting in touch with the cycles of nature again, you know, looking at astronomy, astrology, looking at the planets, the stars, the changes of season, the solstices and equinoxes, you know, and that might lead you to a more earth religion based kind of understanding of life, or more shamanistic, or, you know, kind of, you know, a more traditional way of looking at life that's also valid. And then figuring out a way you can also live in this postmodern technological world we live in, bridging those two things for yourself. You know, it's going to be, and this is the process of individuation that Jung talks about. It's an individual kind of a task now, and that's the challenge for us. You know, before we were contained within a church or a synagogue or a mosque or, you know, some sort of group work, and most of us today are not. You know, thankfully, some of us still have those moorings, but most of us don't. So what do? You know, and that's where this task is now incumbent upon us to find our own path. But there are teachers and there are guidelines and there are traditions that help us to do this, like I said. So those are some ideas. Do you have any ideas to help people find that sort of resurrection of meaning in their own lives?
Well, it's a rebirth, and it's a new birth. It's a very old soul that's getting rebirthed. This meaning that goes all the way back, probably to our origins, or if there's such thing as pre-origin, I would probably go there too, that it needs to be brought back up, invite it in, ask for it to appear. How can it show up in a new way? We live in a, now we're all separated with this pandemic thing that, you know, people are doing on the computer, you know, we're doing a Zoom call right now. Yeah. But that's, you know, but that was, we were doing that beforehand. But now people are actually going to school that way and going to work that way, trying to find new ways, you know, the separated, and then technology is sort of keeping us together, but also separating us at the same time. I like what you're saying about group work. The danger now is that we used to rely, yes, on these churches or organizations when we were maybe more small town, more rural, as a planet, most people, or before then it was more tribal. So you relied on the strength of the tribe, the wisdom of the tribal elders, because elders were respected. That's a myth that I think we've pretty much lost in the West. It has now, and that sustained us because there was good guidance, because it was mythologically correct, if you want to use that term. Now we've become separated, and the danger is that if we look to these institutions as the myth makers and the policy makers and the leaders, they're not equipped to do that, especially left to their own devices. There's this sense of taking it back. So the myth, even though these myths are completely universal, they are deeply, deeply personal, and they may affect us and play out in our lives in different ways, even though we're all part of the same myth, like the ocean, you know, is the same substance of the water, yet each wave, each swell behaves in its own way and has its own size and shape and movement, all seemingly very different expression of this one ocean. So if we can get that going, I think that helps. I feel connected to something, even if I feel separated and, you know, maybe lost on my own, you know, or that I'm in a world that's devoid of meaning, and a government and a culture and these, you know, pop images that are just not the food. I mean, literally the food doesn't have the nutritional value that it needs to sustain life. Same is true with the, you know, these cultural nutritional requirements that we're not getting. We have to look within, and I think we have to take control of ourselves, like self-initiate, re-mythologize ourselves. You know, Gene Houston said it best, when he goes, don't pathologize, mythologize. Find your myth. Find the movie that touches you in some way that's just beyond, oh, it was a good movie, or there was nice action or special effects, that something scratched an itch in your soul that needed to be contacted. books, art, anything like a good piece of music or rock and band that just gets you on some deeper level. And you know the difference. I think everybody does. Mm-hmm. They know what's, you know, kind of plastic and you know, devoid of meat or nutrition. And we also know what fills our soul, what helps us, you know, connect with things. So look there, look at the things in your own life, and grow those, hold on to those. See, these are important. It's not just a movie. Maybe it's not just a movie. Maybe that movie you saw, whether it's Star Wars or Top Gun or who knows, and it touched you in some way, there's something in it for you. You have that, you're connected with that archetype. And even though maybe, okay, you're not Tom Cruise, you're not gonna fly an F-14 off an aircraft carrier, but you've got that maverick in you, and you can learn lessons on how to live your life by the example of even a movie character, even in some action movie like that. There you can find meaning in these things, but you have to find your own meaning. And I think if we can find that in ourselves, then the people we vote for, the companies we buy from, the things that we do and the way we live our life can change. And that will spread out to the world. So I'm a firm believer in kind of an in-out approach, kind of a personal towards the collective, but tap into that universal archetypal energy that some, and you know, I know everybody knows something that affects them in a good way, but in a way that the rest of the world doesn't provide, but maybe this character in the story does, and there you'll find your myth.
There you go. Great point. You know, follow those little threads. I mean, Robert Johnson called those slender threads, those little things that move you, that kind of pull you forward, that you know, give you clues to find the meaning. And you know, look, you know, ask for that guidance from the unconscious, you know, from the spirit, you know, within yourself, and you know, the spirit that, you know, that guides the universe and so on. And watch your dreams, and watch, you know, watch, like Chris pointed out, things that move you, things that you're passionate about. You know, look at your own history, and you know, some of the traditions or cultures or, you know, ethnic groups or whatever that, you know, you belong to, that maybe you've never really followed up on or looked into. Sometimes the mythology of those groups, the stories and folklore of those groups will move you. You know, if you're somebody who doesn't know about your roots, maybe do one of those ancestry things and see where your family came from if you don't know any of the stories, and then trace it back. And, you know, if you're Italian, for example, maybe the, you know, the folklore of Italy and then Roman mythology will really strike a chord with you, and you never really realize that. Maybe there's something in you that, you know, is there that's waiting to be woken up. So, you know, experiment, look at who you are, you know, see what moves you, watch your dreams, ask for the guidance that you need. You know, spirits and, you know, and angels or whatever you want to call them will come to your aid, you know, to help you, to help guide you. So that's something that's there and available for you. So that's, I think, going to do it for us today. Thank you for that great advice and contribution to the show today, Chris. I appreciate it.
All right.
So we are going to be back next Friday with another Fox show. Thank you again for joining us. We appreciate it. We're at anchor.fm/cosmiceye. If you'd like to make a donation, cosmiceye.org. There's more information about us there. Chris's book is The Spirit in the Sky. Mine is If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. Have a great week. Take care of yourselves out there. We appreciate you guys showing up. Goodbye. God bless.